Welcome to the First Things Podcast. On this episode, I'll talk with former assistant editor and podcast regular Alexi Sargent about Game of Thrones, the HBO fantasy series that everyone you know is watching, even if they won't admit it. We'll talk dragons and zombies, monarchy and neoconservatism, and the vices and virtues of the most popular series on television. I'm senior editor Julia Yost. Thanks for joining us. I'm sure that most of our listeners are far too virtuous to watch Game of Thrones on HBO, or to enjoy it if they did. I, however, am not virtuous. Having just concluded its seventh and penultimate season, Game of Thrones enjoys an intense and extensive following and broad critical praise. Above all, it gets itself talked about in a million episode recaps, a few thousand Reddit threads, and 100 woke controversies about this sexist plot arc or that racist scene. In other words, it is prestige television drama par excellence. Content warning: in addition to its many and serious merits, Game of Thrones contains a lot of explicit sex and violence. Viewer discretion is strongly advised. I'm joined by former First Things assistant editor Alexi Sargent, who I'm told has not actually seen the most recent season of Game of Thrones, but he knows the books and series well, and no one else around here even watches it. Alexi, hi.
Hello.
So Game of Thrones is a fantasy franchise based on novels by George R.R. Martin and set in two fictional continents, Westeros and the far less interesting Essos. I'm interested in some parallels between the political life of Westeros and contemporary American political life. Not that Game of Thrones is deeply analytic, I'd call it symptomatic. One of the major plot arcs concerns political and military contestation for the Iron Throne, rulership of Westeros. Within this arc, the series seems to want to chart a movement from autocracy and tribalistic cycles of violence to semi-democratic, coalition-based Wilsonianism. And the two paradigms of governance and war-making are exemplified by the two rival queens, Cersei Lannister and Daenerys Targaryen. So, Alexi, I'm going to give my take on Daenerys, who is sort of this series' ideological darling. And my take is a little contrarian, so then you let me know what you think of it. Daenerys is the daughter of the last deposed Targaryen king. That means she has a claim to the Iron Throne. It also means she has an instinctive rapport with dragons. She spent the first six seasons in exile in Essos, hatching her dragons, mustering her armies, braiding her hair, and extemporizing her political philosophy. She liberates desert peoples from oppressive regimes. She has weapons of mass destruction that turn the desert into glass. She says she wants to make the world a better place. She envisions a coalition of the willing, which will effect regime change in Westeros, and institute a stable, democratic-ish form of governance, serving a liberated polity, with her on top, of course. She's a Targaryen. She's also a neocon. I have no critique of her political philosophy as such, but I do find that the series struggles to embody it in her character. For me, Daenerys has a very severe charisma deficit, a bit of a weakness in a leader, which seems connected to the series' insistence on her fitness to rule, her unique combination of virtue and power. So, Alexi, what is your feeling about Daenerys? Do you get sleepy when she's on screen, as I do, or do you enjoy her and find her, would you vote for her?
You know, I don't think I'm going to vote for Daenerys to sit on the Iron Throne, but that's partly because my belief is that she will destroy the Iron Throne itself as she moves from the political plot line of the story into the magical conflict. And it turns out that her dragons were never meant for conquest so much as for fighting against these evil supernatural forces that everyone else in Westeros has been ignoring in favor of the petty conflict over the question of who will sit in the Iron Throne.
Right, so the White Walkers who are threatening to come down from the north with their zombie army.
Exactly. Yeah, well, I think this is the arc of the whole series, right? George R.R. Martin titled it A Song of Ice and Fire. Now, the television show has kept the title of the first volume, A Game of Thrones, throughout the whole thing. So I can see how,
right,
for the TV audience, there's more of an emphasis on the political drama, Whereas the book series seems to me to be suggesting that politics are in some ways a distraction from the existential threat that, you know, comes from this magical dimension, but suggests a sort of environmental catastrophe.
Climate change, basically.
Yeah, it's a sort of icy wave of fairy undeath heading towards Westeros, and everyone's been distracted by battles over feudal authority to notice.
So which do you prefer? Do you like the sort of existential and climatic conflict, or do you prefer the political and feudal feuding?
I think that as a fantasy fan, I enjoy the move from this political realm into the more fantastical magical realm, though what makes the stakes of that latter thing real are the fact that Martin has created interesting characters that we see first in the political conflict, and then a few of them wake up to the super political threat that has to be faced.
Mm-hmm. I prefer the sort of Machiavellian stagecraft that happens in the capital city of King's Landing. But I am dissatisfied with what I take to be, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but what I take to be the series' depiction of what makes a ruler fit to rule, or rather their failure to propose interesting personalities who would be fit to rule. Right, so fitness to rule will have naturally two components, right? Virtue and power. Season one, Ned Stark, very virtuous, but got rolled by the smart, ruthless contenders for power, lost his head at the end of the season. Cersei Lannister, the current queen, pretty smart, very ruthless, not at all virtuous.
Nope.
Very much doubt she'll be allowed to hang on to her power by the end of the series. She'll certainly die, I would think, as her father did, when her evil deeds come back on her. So Ned,
there's a prophecy to that effect that she's laboring under, too.
Oh, I didn't know that. Ned was never going to be king. Cersei, not fit to be queen. So how can virtue and power be combined in one person? And it seems this series is trying to square that circle in the figure of Daenerys. She's smart enough, she's ruthless, she has three large dragons, as the chorus goes, which is enough power for anyone. Ah, but she's virtuous too, very kind and very just. In my opinion, we don't really see her kindness and justice except in these very convenient, tendentious ways. But her advisors are always insisting, she's our queen, we chose her because she wants to make the world a better place. They keep repeating that cliche throughout season seven. And I can't help noticing that the better place Daenerys envisions is a world in which she's the queen. So she burns her enemies alive because she wants to make the world a better place. Cersei burns her enemies alive because she just wants to rule the world. I find that a distinction almost without a difference. Alexi, am I being too cynical?
No, I think you're picking up on something real as far as this contradiction in the character of Daenerys. I think the problem is that dragons are essentially magical nuclear weapons, and they're too powerful for the world that they live in.
Right.
The history of this fictional world is that this continent-wide kingdom was forged by dragonfire in a way that isn't sort of natural to it. Right, its level of technological and social development isn't up to the level of a continent-wide nation state. It was only kind of kept together by the Iron Fist of the Targaryens with their dragon mounts. And so Daenerys bringing dragons back into the world is at best a mixed blessing. I think it is good that her impulse is to try to use them to end the slave trade and, you know, be the breaker of chains, but we are seeing the contradictions of using that kind of massive force to try to affect social change, because she does create orphans and dissidents everywhere she goes in Essos who want to overthrow her and destroy her and her, you know, what they see as dragon-powered tyranny.
There's obviously a parallel here to American foreign policy, right? Daenerys had this kind of neocon march through the desert in Essos. For six seasons, we watched her take one city after another.
Right.
And under most circumstances, you might, you know, watch that and say, well, this is a power-mad person grabbing territory to which she has no democratic or dynastic right, but she feels entitled because she has the biggest arsenal. And the series says, oh no, but these are slave cities. She's liberating them, so she's a good conqueror. There's some breakage and spillage, but she's basically good. And to me, that's a kind of ethical shortcut that is very familiar from, you know, debates about the Iraq War. Hmm. It leaves me cold, the notion of her goodness as a conqueror and a ruler, in part because I feel no emotional connection to the desert cities she has liberated. So much of Essos is very virtual, very computer generated.
It's more thinly sketched than Westeros is.
Very little socio-political thickness on that continent. The delineation of cultures there is very cursory, at least in the series. Maybe it's different in the books. So my feeling is that these slave cities really exist only so that Daenerys can conquer / liberate them. They seem purpose-built for this very, to my mind, tendentious narrative that her campaign of domination is also a campaign of liberation. Her exercise of power is also an exercise of virtue. Though, as you say, there is this depiction of her getting bogged down in this quagmire over there in a way that, again, is very familiar.
Yeah, the Marine story arc reads strongly as an Iraq war metaphor, where she decides she's going to sit down with her dragons and learn to rule this city, and, you know, it's plagued by insurgencies and people who, you know, resent her imposing her cultural values on this foreign place.
Would you agree, though, that basically the series approves of her neoconservatism? They think she's basically right in trying to effect these regime changes and impose her better values.
Maybe.
You don't think so?
I don't know. As a book reader, I'm kind of always alive to the like general anti-war theme that Martin has going. So it does make me question even characters who are coded as heroic, whether all of their decisions that end in conquest are supposed to be justified.
Right. But she wants to make the world a better place. Aren't we supposed to buy that?
I think that the other candidate for someone who's being kind of groomed to be a portrait of virtuous power is Sansa Stark, who's someone who's doesn't have dragons, right? Doesn't have an army per se, but through her kind of interactions with the corrupt and abusive aristocracy of Westeros, it seems to me coming towards a realization of a better way to be a ruler, and a way to be a ruler who's accountable to her people, which is why I am all in favor of Sansa Stark, Queen in the North, at the end of the series of books and television shows.
Yeah, see, I like that because, again, it shows me politics as politics instead of politics as, you know, a different storyline in a show that's basically about, you know, magic and climate change. I like seeing Sansa in the hall at Winterfell, kind of talking to her knights and trying to manage them and their egos and their different demands. That just feels very earthy and practical to me.
Yeah.
And it shows her being, you know, smart, but also as virtuous as she can manage to be.
I mean, if you'll permit me to just theorize wildly, I think that what the ultimate kind of outcome of this story of Ice and Fire is that the fantasy elements, the dragons and the White Walkers, will sort of exhaust themselves, right? The dragons will die heroically destroying the White Walker army. Like, fire and ice will exhaust themselves and will be left with a Westeros that has no kind of magical thing uniting it into one polity, and we'll see a lot of, you know, individuals trying to pull together their smaller kingdoms within Westeros. So we'll get to see Sansa ruling in the North and the Greyjoy siblings trying to enact reforms on the Iron Island. So it could be that after all the fantasy strum and drang, we will see a little more, you know, hints of this personal local politics throughout the world of Westeros.
We need to talk about dragons. What are the dragons there for? Obviously, this is a fantasy series. There have to be dragons. What's kind of symbolic work are they doing? Obviously, they give Daenerys power, ultimate power. I think they're also intended to make up for her, what I find to be her charisma deficit. They're supposed to be very sublime, terrifying, and beautiful.
Right.
And we're, I think, supposed to transpose their charisma onto Daenerys, their mother. She's the mother of dragons. For me, this doesn't really work because this is partly a technical and aesthetic problem again. At least until this season, the dragons have been such slapdash CGI video game creatures. They're more visually convincing this season. They're still visually ugly. Hmm. They make these horrible nails on the chalkboard, screeching noises. I do not enjoy having them on screen.
So you want dragons that are still deadly, but a little more beautiful.
I would love beautiful dragons. I would be totally into that. Hmm. But I had immense schadenfreude this season when, spoiler alert, and maybe you don't know this, Alexi, one of the dragons gets killed by a White Walker. It's amazing. And then my schadenfreude was redoubled when the dragon was raised from the dead and became a zombie dragon.
I feel like you do like the fantasy elements of this show.
What I like about the zombie dragon is that, okay, you're a fantasy series. You've got zombies and you've got dragons. Might as well go crazy and have a zombie dragon. I mean, don't hold back. Just go nuts with it. Mm-hmm. If you're going to do it, do it. So I liked that because it was so ridiculous. But overall, I'm down on the concept of the dragons, I think, okay, and what they do for Daenerys. What is your feeling about the dragons?
My feeling is Martin has created a world where dragons are kind of the key fantasy element. You know, there is other magic in Westeros, but dragons are the kind of most powerful piece of magic that's existed in the history of this world and has kind of warped the whole world in its own image. Because the slave empires of Essos were created by people riding dragons, and the kind of unified political body of Westeros was created by people riding dragons. So Daenerys having the last three dragons ends up kind of representing a sort of last gasp of this crucial magical element of the world. So like I said, I sort of see magic going away by the end of the series, the way that magical elements often kind of are viewed with nostalgia by the end of many fantasy stories, including the granddaddy of them all, the Lord of the Rings. So I'm okay with dragons kind of wreaking a final sort of path of destruction and transformation over Westeros, because my belief is that by the end of this whole story, there will be no more dragons and we'll be watching again humans pick things up and figure things out in the wake of these creatures.
Yeah, it's interesting because I have tended to think of the dragons as technology, yeah, you know, war-making technology. They're like the bomb or they're like drones.
Right. I mean, they're the only kind of way aerial warfare can happen, right, in this world of feudal era technology.
Yeah, but there's also something very archaic and nostalgic about them. Mm-hmm. I think another thing that the dragons are doing is they're supposed to make up for Daenerys' maternity deficit, right? So one of her titles is Mother of Dragons, and she had hatched these three dragons from eggs that had supposedly been petrified. She says repeatedly that she cannot have children biologically, and so the dragons are her children. She means that as literally as possible, and the series tries to depict her feeling for them as truly maternal, as in, you know, scenes where a dragon is wounded and then she's, you know, tending to it and trying to pull out the spear or the arrow, and that plangent dragon music plays. That stuff leaves me cold, in part because dragons are not humans. They're not even animals. They're bundles of binary code. They have no personality. I don't think the series depicts them as having real personality. They register for me as weapons, as manned or unmanned combat warcraft, basically as drones.
So Daenerys tenderly touching the dragon is like that Onion article of Obama patting the drone goodnight.
I didn't know about that, but that's exactly how it registers for me. I'm far more moved by Cersei's maternal feeling for her three children, one of whom was a monster, and she's arguably
like
a monster, right? But all three of her children had personalities, actually, because they were humans. And that makes a difference to me, because they're children and not pets or drones. So I think it's important, though, that Daenerys is childless. She had a husband who died, gave birth to their child who died. Since then, she believes she's infertile. And then she hatched the dragons and became this great figure of power and liberation.
Right.
So I think there's a connection between her childlessness and her standing for liberation, right? The breaker of chains is also the mother of dragons, not of children, of dragons. Daenerys possesses great power and freedom, and she can't tell the difference, apparently, between human children and prestige pets. In other words, she's a millennial.
I think that the situation with children throughout this world is interesting, because Daenerys isn't the only leader of Westeros who has no children or has fewer children than you would expect a family to have in a feudal society where childbearing is a political act that secures your dynasty, and if you're a good ruler, helps secure the security and safety of your people. And only the virtuous Stark family has a large brood of offspring. The other great houses of Westeros have like two or three children, and there's sort of a running theme of crimes against the natural family throughout these corrupt, decadent nobles who engage in incest and in sodomy and in abortion. So there is a sort of sense that part of the political and personal ramification of the existential threat of the White Walkers is reflected in the strange infertility of the ruling class of Westeros. Another thing that we could, you know, venture to make an analogy to the present situation, where people have pointed out that, you know, oddly enough, most of the leaders of Europe are childless these days. And, you know, in each individual case, it could be a tragedy or an understandable choice, but taken in aggregate, it's a strange portrait of a society that may be succumbing to a kind of despair.
Let's take up a topic now that is highly unsavory. One of the distinctive vices of Game of Thrones, as you've just alluded to, is the frequency with which some of its characters engage in incest. So there's incest practiced by a very evil character who lives north of the Wall. More centrally, there's the historic incest of House Targaryen, which presumably contributed to the madness of the Targaryen kings.
Trying to keep their bloodline pure,
right.
They kind of descended into madness and decay.
Yeah. And of course, there's the open secret incest of the Lannister twins, Cersei and her brother Jaime. For a long time, I was uncertain how to read that preoccupation. It just seems, I mean, I understand this is HBO, but really? So I was uncertain about that for a long time. I begin to have clearer ideas about it. But I mean, Alexi, you had begun to formulate a certain reading of these crimes against the natural family, which particularly characterize the noble houses. So,
you
know, the central incest is dynastic incest.
Yeah, agreed, which, you know, read metaphorically suggests a family kind of collapsing in on itself, right? Unable to reach out and, you know, love other people. It's kind of self-love on a familial level that has soured into this, you know, terrible incestuous relationship that, in Cersei and Jaime's case, turns into a soft usurpation, where her adultery with her brother is her way of supplanting her husband and his children from inheriting the throne, because she will, you know, secretly put a pure Lannister on the throne.
You know, for a while I had thought that the series was making some kind of progressive political point. So there's a season 5 episode in which Jaime starts to tell his daughter that he's her father as well as her uncle. And she cuts him off and tells him she knows about it already, she's figured it out, and she's very glad because she knows we can't control whom we love.
Yeah.
So it looked to me, at least for a minute, like the series was using incest to push the Overton window in the direction of love is love. But I do think that broadly, the series basically stigmatizes these acts.
That moment where Jamie's daughter niece reveals that she knows he's her father is punctuated by her dying
her death,
of poison.
Yeah. Right.
Right. And incest is itself a type of poison.
Right.
You know, mythologically, incest is often the kind of the mark of corruption. And I think that that's absolutely part of what's going on in Westeros. You know, I understand the latest season introduced a like accidental aunt-nephew incest.
Oh, it's very, it's hard to know how to parse that, honestly. even just in terms of the political outlook of the series, clearly these incestuous relationships in the noble houses are intensifications of endogamy and tribalism, as you've said.
Right.
It's a sort of turning against the polity, turning into the house. But for Daenerys and her fellow neocon Jon Snow then to end up in a relationship when they're the kind of propositional universalist leaders doesn't make as much sense to me theoretically. Now, they don't know that they're family, so that becomes a little less incongruous that way. But I think the series has really put viewers in a strange situation with respect to that. It's a weird choice.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as someone who reads the books more than he watches the shows, I can kind of, you know, sit back and say, ah, here's HBO just being
could be, yeah,
prurient at this point. But I'm not certain. All I know is that there's this theme, right, of kind of incest and other kind of crimes against children, right? Jamie's introduced pushing a child out of a window in order to cover up his crime of incest, that suggests a real sickness at the heart of the people ruling Westeros right now that will end up, you know, having untold consequences and then hopefully leaving some survivors to create a, you know, if not completely chastened, at least a little bit purified polity in the wake of it. Martin has spoken of the ending he envisions for the series being bittersweet, which is what I cling to when, you know, people say that they worry that it'll just be a total apocalypse where the whole cast is massacred. And
That's not going to happen.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, the series is famous for pulling the rug a little out from under folks, killing
right.
the ostensible
Anyone
main
can
character.
Die.
And having a massacre at a wedding that is sort of legendary in the lore. But I think all of those moments are more examples of the evils that are roiling the body politic of Westeros. And I note that they're often crimes against things that people hold sacred, like the family, like the relationship between guest and host. And so there is a sense that the ostensible values of Westeros, what it says it holds sacred, are good on some level. It's just that people routinely fail to live up to that, and there is a, you know, widespread cynicism in the people who are supposedly supposed to hold up these values. So what we see in the show that I like is some of the younger characters rejecting that cynicism and trying to actually live out those values. This is why Sansa is a favorite character of mine, and this is why Brienne of Tarth is a favorite character of mine.
I love Brienne. Can you just describe the character of Brienne really quickly?
Brienne is
she's such a bright spot.
A young woman of great size and strength who's mocked for this because she doesn't fit into the conventional ladylike mold in Westeros. And she ends up backing into becoming a real knight-errant, where though she's not really a knight because she's simply a woman with a sword, she finds her way to saving the ordinary people of the countryside from robbers and brigands and becoming a person who is a holy fool for chivalry. You know, though people mock her, she is the one who really holds up the values of knighthood. You know, people sometimes accuse the whole series of being a nihilistic deconstruction of fantasy tropes, and I think there are some moments that suggest that, but overall what's going on is a attempt at a reconstruction of the tropes of the fantasy genre in a sort of existential mode, where some of the characters kind of hope against hope and choose against the cynical and corrupt world that they see to actually try to live out the values of being knightly, being ladylike. And so that's why Brienne and Sansa are some of my top favorites, and I hope that in the Westeros to come, we see more people embodying those values.
Yeah, the other thing about Brienne is that she's extremely loyal.
Mm-hmm.
She's very self-sacrificingly loyal. She was loyal to her first king, Renly, and then she was very loyal to a vow she had made to Catelyn Stark
yeah.
to protect both of her daughters, find and protect both of her daughters. She's also, this is a much more conflicted thing, but she's also a quite loyal friend to Jaime Lannister.
Mm-hmm.
And she seemed very much, when they were sort of on the road together for complicated reasons, and they were sort of waylaid by these other soldiers who abused both of them, being in partnership with Brienne really seemed to bring out goodness in Jaime.
Yeah.
Jaime's a very complicated character. I really admire, actually, the craft of Martin and the series in holding together that character. It's very, and the craft of the actor, Nikolai Coster-Waldau, in yeah. embodying him. Very capable of great evil and also very capable of great decency, and they managed to make his personality very coherent. And his defense of Brienne when her virtue was under attack and then her life was under attack was this just kind of wonderfully persuasive and also inspiring kind of heroism on the part of a character whose soul, if I can use Christian terms, is very much unclear which way his soul is going to go.
Yeah, I think it's a interesting reworking of the Beauty and the Beast story. Because, mm-hmm. of course, Jaime is beautiful, and Brienne is called a beast by people who see her, you know, her huge size and denigrate her. But she is the one who has the kind of shining soul, and Jaime is kind of inspired to try to be a real knight by her, right? Jaime, who has broken so many vows and done so many terrible things, is kind of pulled a little back from the brink by her, and we'll see if that redemption arc, you know, arcs up at all anymore, right? But there's certainly a moment of grace in the way that Jaime responds to what is actually admirable in Brienne after initially dismissing her. I've not watched the season of the show, but I've been made aware that by virtue of this season bringing together characters who never met in the books, there's been a sort of romance developed between the boisterous, red-bearded barbarian Tormund Giantsbane and our favorite lady knight, Brienne of Tarth. And I hear Tormund Giantsbane fantasizing about a future where he and Brienne can have enormous, beautiful babies together. And that is clearly the pronatalism that Westeros needs to defeat the coming darkness and cold. So Brienne and Tormund forever. That is my final word on Game of Thrones.
We ship them. That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to my former colleague, Alexi Sargent. Thank you, listeners. And remember, it's not TV, it's HBO. You've been warned.